I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today is my good friend Dimitri Karyotis, and he just came out with a new collection of stories, his very first book called The Quiet Time. On Poetic License, we have another good friend of mine, Azucena Dominguez, and she's going to tell us about her first kiss. Stick around, it's going to be a great show. This morning, I was reading that McDonald's, its profits has gone down 30%. Which doesn't mean they're not making a gazillion dollars like they do every year, just that their profits have gone down a bit. But get this, this is the reason, and I quote, "Americans are making more healthy choices such as Chipotle." Really? Chipotle is the healthy choice? How bad does your food have to be for Chipotle to be the paragon of eating healthy? If you go to Chipotle, you know that they take a tortilla the size of a tablecloth, which must be about 180 carbs, and then they stuff it with another 80 carbs of rice, a bunch of beans, your choice of fatty meat, and then they top it off with cheese and sour cream. They roll up the tortilla, and it's bigger than your head. That's healthy? Well, I guess you can have lettuce and tomatoes on it, but maybe it's less bad than McDonald's. That's about the best we can say. And as Americans, I think our addiction to bad food is at such extreme levels that we believe, as gospel, that less bad is better. It's not. Less bad is still bad. I could be eating a 12-inch tuna sandwich from Subway, piled with three kinds of cheese, swimming in a pool of mayonnaise with chunks of salty pickled things, and I say to myself as I'm eating all 12 inches of it, "Well, at least it's better than a double cheeseburger. It's tuna." No, just because something is theoretically less bad doesn't make it better. That would be like, "Well, I only murdered that one family. It's less bad than killing the neighbors, too." I know, killing people and eating bad food isn't the same thing, but it kind of is, because with every Subway sandwich I eat, I'm stabbing myself. But I admit it, it's not easy to eat healthy, especially in El Paso, where we have so many good independent Mexican restaurants. You can get a plate of three fried tacos stuffed with ground beef, potatoes, and cheese with a side of beans and rice for 22 cents. It's a lot cheaper than paying $14 for salmon salad. Yeah, you can get salads now at fast food chains, but they're covered in grated cheddar cheese. Who puts cheddar cheese on a salad? And they have bacon bits and sugary raisins, and they're smothered with dressing made of oil and milk. Ugh. El Paso is one of the U.S. cities with the highest rate of diabetes and obesity, but it's not our fault. I blame it on our parents. It's hard to eat healthy when you grow up like me, Mexican. When I was a kid, my mom fried potatoes in lard, and they were so greasy that if you didn't eat them fast enough and they cooled off, the lard would congeal on the roof of your mouth. We had to scrape it off with a tortilla. And if we ate broccoli, which we sometimes did, it came from a frozen bag. And my mom boiled it into a puree, and then she poured it into a casserole dish with cheese and milk and bacon, and then she baked it. And then the only remaining evidence that a vegetable used to exist are these pieces that float around like space debris inside an ether of gelatinous lactose. And the only raw vegetable we ever ate as kids was iceberg lettuce for our tacos. And iceberg lettuce has about the nutritional value of licking water off your uncle's face. Not that you'd want to do that, but my point is it's hard to break those habits when you're an adult. I try to eat healthy. I try to have a vegetable with every meal, broccoli, spinach, Salisbury steak. And I buy vegetables. The problem is I buy them, but they go bad on me. My vegetables always go bad. My broccoli joined a motorcycle gang. Okay, that's a bad joke. But stick around, and we are going to talk to Dimitri Karyotis about his new book, The Quiet Time. Dimitri Karyotis earned his MFA in creative writing from CSU Chico. His short fiction has appeared in, or is forthcoming in, the Belote Fiction Journal, which is a great one, Georgetown Review, Flyway, Border Senses, which is a fantastic journal right here out of El Paso, and elsewhere. He has also written for Poets and Writers. SFA Press just came out with his debut collection of stories, which we're going to talk about today, called The Quiet Time. Dimitri, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks, Daniel. Great to be here.
And congratulations on this book, The Quiet Time, which is your very first book. Tell me about how this book came about, how long it took you, and what it feels like to have it out.
Yeah.
Because I know you've been working on this for a long time.
I've been working on this a long time, and it's funny. I think I wrote the first piece that is in this book in 2004, and that piece is Fleeing, which is the last story in the collection, the 11th story. But, you know, it goes back to I was in my MFA program at Chico State here in California, and I overlooked a deadline, and I had to write a story in a weekend. Mm-hmm. And I sat down to do so, and I tapped into this experience that I'd had in Central Africa. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in what was once Zaire, which is today's Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. And I sat down, and I started recollecting and writing about this one experience, and it just flowed from the pen. I mean, it just poured out, and I wrote a 16-page story in less than 2 days, which I'd never done before, and I certainly haven't done since. And what I learned from that is just, you know, go to the heat and write about those experiences and spin them in ways that'll work on the page. The experiences that mean the most to you, and everybody's heard this before. I'd heard it, but I'd never really done it. And that led me to keep writing about my experiences in Central Africa. And because there was a lot of heat around my time there, especially because we were pulled out of there overnight because of some emergency situations. And my point in answering your question is, I told myself that I was going to write all those stories, and it ended up being 7 stories. And at first I thought that was going to be the collection, but then, you know, I kind of wrote Central Africa out of me, and I started exploring other things. And it took 9 years to get the collection to where I wanted it, or 9 years from the time I wrote the one piece that's in here all the way to when SFA Press picked it up nearly a year ago. And so, given all that you've done, I'm sure you know about, you know, you go through times when you're discouraged and you're tired, and you're tired of the stories themselves, and and, you know, you put the pen down for a couple months, and then something happens, and you read something in Poets and Writers, and then you pick it up again, and you get charged. And so that was kind of it for me, and I just kept plodding along. But it was really the past 2 years when I just felt this surge, and I was so tired of this body of work that I thought, all right, it's time for it to go out into the world alone. And, you know, you guys don't need me anymore. I'm going to shove you out the door. And so I revised them multiple times again. And luckily by then I had enough publications, individual publications and literary journals, that it looked appealing enough, I think, to shop. And then SFA Press invited me, and I was absolutely thrilled because they were certainly on my radar. And so that was kind of the experience in a nutshell. I mean, I can go on from there.
That's wonderful, though. I love how you describe it, you know, how there's these moments. And I know I've experienced it, as you've said, or as you suggested, that where, you know, you just don't believe in it anymore and you want to give up. But it's a commitment. It's almost like a relationship. You know, there are going to be times in a relationship where you just think, you know, this is not going to work. But I think the better choice is, rather than giving up on the relationship, working it. And then you will find that book will present itself to you. And obviously that's what you did.
Yeah. And, you know, I love your analogy as far as relationship, because there were times for me, and there are a couple stories in here that are really important to me because of they're so based on actual events. And, you know, they weren't getting picked up by literary journals. And I didn't want to throw in the towel because I loved them so much. And I felt like I owed it to the people involved in the stories. And so it was just a matter of, you know, realizing that it was going to happen and seeing through the dark, lonely days and all the rejection slips that I would get, you know, sometimes three or four in a day. And at least for me, too, it was just to keep reading, exploring different literary journals and see what was getting published and to see, okay, well, these writers are doing this. Okay, well, I shouldn't bump up my game to try to meet their quality. But it is. It's so much like a relationship.
Especially for me, you know, writing a book is like a marriage. You know, once you finish it, you go ahead and go on to the next.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, what's funny is that you asked what it felt like. I mean, the point of utter elation was it happened on December 13th of this past year. And I came into the office to wrap up. I'm an instructor at Modesto Junior College. And I know to wrap up my grades and just kind of close it, button up my office and then leave for a month. And I came into the most wonderful email, which was from SFA, and they said, "Good news, we'd love to publish your book if it's still available to us."
That's the best email to get ever for a writer, isn't it?
Oh my gosh. And you know, you probably can relate, but because I had sent this thing out so many times, and you know, you're always dreaming of this day, and so when it arrives, at least for me, I just stared at the screen. Uh-huh. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, hold on. Is this really for real? You know, and I checked their address, and it said SFA Press. And I thought, well, it seems legit. And so, you know, and then you're over the moon, and I called my wife and what have you. But yeah, that was the moment. And for me, when I finally saw it, when it came out, you know, because of the galley process and editing it a million times, I was so sick of those pieces. And I remember you telling me once that, you know, by the time your book comes out, you're really done with those stories and you are looking ahead. And that's what I've found myself doing. I mean, not to undermine their importance in my life, but it's an exhausting process, right? And so you're just kind of tired, but you're also very excited, obviously.
You know, one of the impulses that I had when my first book, Chicano Chicanery, came out was to just, when I did readings, to read from the novel I was working on. And, and that ended up not being a very good idea because I didn't respect the one that was already out there. So I think that might have caused other people to think, well, wait a minute, what's wrong with that book that he was already on the second one? So, yeah, it's really important to respect your book. I want to get back to something you said, which I found really interesting. I've known you for many years. You teach at Modesto Junior College. I used to teach there. And even though we weren't there at the same time, I've been back many times. And I've always enjoyed our conversations. And I know you study craft. I know you teach creative writing. Mm. And that you're always thinking about technique. You're always thinking about the craft of fiction, the art of fiction, not only theoretically, but practically.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we know as writers is that the more we study craft, the more we study the nuts and bolts of technique, the more it becomes intuitive and just kicks in intuitively when during the writing process.
Yeah.
And so you were talking about this story in grad school that you wrote, you know, 16 pages in 2 days. I imagine since then, and as you're learning more and more craft, that might have happened on a lot of these other stories too. Which story was the most wow, how did that happen story, where you just wrote it and then you read it and go, my gosh, that was brilliant?
You know, it's probably the title piece. I don't know if I wrote it and I thought it was brilliant, but I was certainly the most
come
moved
on, admit
by
it. We all think it's brilliant the first week and then we think it's crappy, but we got to believe in our own work.
Right. Well, and I believed in it. You know, it's interesting because, and perhaps you can relate, but sometimes stories just hit us, and it's as if they're banging to be let out, mm-hmm. you know? And one night I was wrapping up in the office here after a long day at work, and it was dark out. No one was in this building. And this story, it was really a reflection on the final days of my father's life, and it's called The Quiet Time. And I just sat down to write a couple sentences because a few sentences came to mind. And I ended up staying for a few hours and writing the whole piece in one sitting, which I know Raymond Carver did that all the time, but I'm not one to do that. You know, I'll kind of max out after five or six pages. Mm-hmm. And so I just wrote it, and I was so moved by it. And it was such an important story to me, and I was in tears throughout the process off and on as I thought about mm-hmm. my father's life and our connection. And we were especially close in the latter years of his life. And I thought, this has legs. But the moment that I was really pleased with is I didn't care about publication. I didn't care about anything. I was really thrilled that I went and explored that story because I better understood so much from writing it. That took it to a different level, right? It took it outside of which literary journal might pick it up or whether it was just really important to me. And then in looking at it, you know, in looking at the craft, I thought, okay, this has good emotional heat. And I think it'll work for readers, too. And that seemed to be the byproduct then, right?
Well, you know, that's wonderful. I like how you said that you reached a point where you didn't care about publication, because I think when you're working on something and you're thinking about, is this going to get published, it's probably going to be superficial. You have to let it go. It's almost like, since we're comparing writing to relationships, it's almost like when you're looking for somebody, you're kind of creeping everybody out.
That's right.
You let go of that desire to look for somebody, and it happens.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, what's funny is that was one of the two pieces that mean the most to me, if not the most to me, and I shopped that. I sent it to so many different journals, and it was rejected all over the place. And then right before the book was picked up, two journals were interested in
nice,
it.
Nice.
You know, and it didn't matter. I mean, I was thrilled with it, and I believed in it, and then in the end, you know, it all came through. But that's just taught me, you know, go to that. Well, Robert Olin Butler says, right from your white hot center. And so, you know, I've been fortunate to go there when necessary.
I'm talking to Dimitri Kariotis about his new book, The Quiet Time. First book, a collection of stories. You mentioned Robert Olin Butler, and I think we had a conversation about that book one time. And one of the things that he suggests is that before, right when you get up in the morning, before you use language in any other way, start writing.
Yep.
Is that what you do?
That's what I do when I'm in the groove. And I can remember us talking once, and I said, do you write every day? And you said, if I'm in a story, then I owe it to that story to return to it every day until it's done. And if I don't...
Did I say that? I sound
yes,
pretty
you
smart.
Did.
And,
yeah.
And if
did.
I don't, what? I can't wait to hear what else I said.
And you know, I think that's great advice. And I took
wait,
that
but you
advice.
Said, I also said, if I don't, then what?
You said, and if I don't, I better have a damn good reason why I'm not in the seat doing it.
Wow.
And you said it with such conviction that, you know, it really moved me. And so that's what I do. If I'm in a story, then I certainly visit it daily. Now, if I'm really on my game, then it is early in the morning, probably between 5:30 and 7. Our kids get up around 7, and once that happens, then my attention shifts. But yeah, and when I have done that, I get the most out of it. And it's a beautiful, quiet time in the morning, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, the house is usually quiet, and the world is just starting to wake up, and it's really a nice time. And I'm fresh in the morning. I'm ready to roll. And so, yeah, Robert Owen Butler's advice is well taken by this author.
And not only that, but if you wake up early enough and it's still dark outside and you're working and you're writing and you have a window open,
that's right.
Things start to take shape.
Forms
exactly. become visible. And that's kind of what the writing process is itself. We start out in darkness and we just
that's right.
follow it and follow it and follow it. But as the light begins to come up, even just on a metaphorical level, morning
that's
light
right.
is the most healthy light there is. So
it
seems, you know, that's the time one should write.
I totally agree. And seeing that early morning lights, you know, start to take shape outside and the world start to become clear, that's magical time.
Right. But, you
it
know,
just is.
I think a lot of writers, when they start out, they're younger. You know, they start out in their teens or their 20s and they stay up all night writing. I know that was the case for me, and I assume it might have been the case for you, too, because you know, the clock that they're running on, they can frankly sleep until 1 o'clock.
That's right.
You know, I can't sleep till 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
You know, but I think that, you know, you get a certain rhythm and you start to set your biological clock with the actual universal clock.
And, that's right.
And you find a rhythm. This is a very mature book for our first book. We have everyone from Evelyn, who's a 63-year-old woman, and then we have Kevin Sinclair, who was one of my favorite stories, by the way. You showed me that story years ago, but I love that story. It's about somebody's running for school president and promises that they're going to put chocolate milk in the water fountains. And the kid just believes them and makes Kevin Sinclair his hero. It's a beautiful, beautiful, innocent, heartbreaking story. And you have stories that take place in Zaire. You have stories that take place in the Central Valley of California.
Mm.
It's really quite a diverse collection. Does this diversity in the story represent the diversity in Dimitri Kariotis?
Well, you know, I was fortunate to travel a lot in my 20s and spend a lot of those years overseas. And those times really greatly shaped me. And it's not surprising to see stories that take place in the Congo as well as in Greece come out of my pen. You know, as well, growing up in the Central Valley, I grew up in Yuba City, California, and I worked in my father's store. He owned a liquor store, and then I worked in agriculture when I was a little more mature. And those are times that really shape you. And then living again in the Central Valley after years here in Modesto, you start to see connections, right? And so all I can say is that, yeah, my past has certainly influenced my writing. I mean, that's where I go, and I'm constantly haunted by what Charles Baxter calls the haunted image, right, or the widowed image, excuse me. And the one that you mentioned in Kevin Sinclair about this young boy coming in and who's running for student body president and saying, if I'm elected president, I'll put chocolate milk in all the drinking fountains. I mean, that happened. That happened when I was in second grade. And I can't tell you how much I believed in him. And, you know, it was my first taste into politics, obviously, and believing in something that wasn't going to happen.
And you learned your lesson after that. All politicians are liars.
Many of them are, certainly. Right. But, you know, I mean, these are, and throughout these pieces, there are images that come up, and they'll haunt me. They'll haunt me when I'm at the board teaching something, or if I'm lecturing on something. They'll haunt me when I'm driving. They'll haunt me when I'm walking home, whatever. And so, I mean, what's interesting to me, though, is that ever since writing, like, that story, Kevin Sinclair, and writing these other pieces, some of the prominent images in them, they certainly visit me once in a while, but not nearly as frequently.
Oh, because you've exercised them in a sense.
I guess.
You know, every writer gets this question, and as you start to do your book tour, you're going to get this question. How do you get your ideas? And I think Borges has the most brilliant answer to that I've ever heard. He says, I don't get ideas. I try to get rid of them. And he says, ones that wrestle me to the ground and won't let me go that I give into and write.
Right.
And that's
right.
True. I mean, if you're aware, if you are in the moment, and to be a writer really does mean that you should spend the majority of your time in the moment.
That's right.
If you are in the moment, there is just too much to write about.
I totally agree. And what's funny for me, and I'd love to know if you can relate, I know when I'm not doing myself justice because I haven't written enough, when I will be walking somewhere, or I'll be at a market, and all of a sudden I'll see something that happens, something that looks pretty trivial, but then I'll start to spin a story out of it right away.
Nice.
And that's always, you know, my cue that I have to get back to the page. I need to get back to writing. And it's usually if I haven't written for like a month or something like that, which seems like a long time, but it's true. It's like things just start bubbling up, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's always my personal cue to get back to it.
We have been talking to Dimitri Kariotis about his new book, The Quiet Time, a beautiful collection of stories. We're running out of time, Dimitri, but very quickly, let us know what you're working on now.
You know, I'm revisiting that story that I mentioned, the one that I wrote in 2 days. That's called Swine Fever, and it's about an experience.
Swine Fever, like that skit from Saturday Night Live.
Sure,
you got Swine Fever.
Right. And it's about a time when I was in the Congo, and I was obsessed with killing someone's pigs who were ravaging the village. And I took it upon myself to become like this vigilante. But it's a story that I've never been able to complete, and it has many drafts. But that's one that I'm working on. I have other stories I'm returning to also that just they're not fully matured, and so I need to fully cook those. I recently had an idea for a novel, and so that's out there too. But that endeavor scares me a little still.
Yeah,
so.
That's like a even longer marriage.
I can imagine.
We've been talking to Dimitri Kariotis. Dimitri, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Oh, Daniel, thank you so much. I'm a huge fan of your show. It's been a pleasure.
This is Azucena Dominguez, and I'm a retired mathematics teacher.
I taught for 36 years, and I've been writing for a few years. I belong to Tumble Words Writing Project, and I've done a few open mics and read at a few poetry readings. The story that I'm going to read is when I was 9 years old. My mother had passed away, and my dad was working. So my sister wanted to go someplace without permission. My first kiss. I was 9 years old, and my sister was 12, on the day that her friend Ignacio had invited her to meet him behind this really high rock wall. My dad was an underground miner, so that afternoon, he was working the evening shift. He was super strict with us, and we were not allowed to go anywhere without his permission. My sister had already decided to meet her handsome fellow, so I told her that if she didn't take me with her, I would tell on her. She relayed this to Ignacio, who decided to bring his 9-year-old brother, Angel, to keep me busy so that we would not disturb them. We got to the rock wall about 12 feet high, as it was one of the walls around an old warehouse, and my sister and Ignacio told Angel and me that we were to stay on the opposite side of the wall until they called us. Angel and I kept staring at each other, but didn't say a word. He was just as handsome as his brother, too. We were both so shy that we could not even have a conversation. About 20 minutes went by when my sister yelled out that we were going to leave. Angel looked at me and said, "Can I kiss you on the mouth?" I said, "Yes." Well, he kissed me and he bit my lower lip really hard. I honestly don't think he was aware of this, but boy, did it hurt. As my sister and I were walking to our home, I could feel that my lip was starting to swell. I didn't want to tell her about it, but I kept thinking to myself, "Man, I'll never go out with that guy again. He doesn't know how to kiss." Of course, that was my first kiss, and I probably didn't know either. I hid in the bedroom after grabbing an ice cube and kept it on my lip for a while to help with the swelling. If my sister did notice, she did not say anything, as she was on cloud 9 after being with Ignacio. So that was my first kiss, and it wasn't a pleasant experience for me. But then, I was 9 years old. For Words on a Wire, this is Azucena Dominguez.
Thank you for joining me for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank my guest and my good friend, Dimitri Kariotis, for discussing his brand new book, The Quiet Time. You have to read this collection of stories. It is awesome. And I'd like to thank my good friend, Azucena Dominguez, for sharing her touching words about her first kiss. And I'd also like to thank, and I don't do this quite enough, our producer, Norma Martinez. She is amazing. And if it wasn't for her, this show wouldn't be as awesome as it is. So thank you, Norma. Don't forget to join us every week at the same time. And also, remember, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.